I have come to the end of this faithful depiction of the interlude at Shechem, which later was the occasion of so much extenuating fable, saga, and fine writing. Extenuating in favor of Israel, with reference to the sequence of events which led up to the extremity, if not to the extremity itself. For that gave no ground for extenuation, and indeed the saga dwells in pride and vain boasting upon its uttermost frightful detail. Thanks to their disgraceful stratagem, the people of Jacob, though far outnumbered, being only 50 men all told, had an easy victory over the Shechemites. The wall was almost bare of watchers when they noiselessly and easily mounted it with cords and scaling ladders. Once inside, they threw off all disguise and hurled themselves upon the startled inhabitants in a furious onslaught with which the latter, in their maimed state, were little calculated to deal. For every man-child in Shechem, whether old or young, suffered from fever, and was busy unbinding and binding up his wound, not excepting the greater part of the garrison. Whereas the Ebrim were sound of limb, and their spirits unitedly inflamed by the cries of Dinah, which they shouted ever and anon at their bloody work. They raged like lions. They were here, there, and everywhere at once, and from the first moment the souls of the citizens perceived them as an oncoming and inescapable calamity, so that they offered little or no resistance. Simeon and Levi, the instigators of the plot, were the most frightful of all. They practiced a battle cry like the roaring of a bull, making the innards of the hearer to quake, and possessing its victim with that fear of God which makes him seek refuge from death in flight alone, and never by any chance in battle. "Woe, alas!" they all cried. "These are not men. This is Sutek, come among us. Baal the Glorious is in all their members." And as they fled, they were struck down with the naked club. Literally, with fire and sword, the Hebrews worked their will. From city, castle, and temple went up clouds of smoke. The streets and houses swam in blood. Only the physically strong were taken prisoner. The rest were strangled. And if horrors were perpetrated upon the dead, we must remember, in extenuation, that the doers were no less involved than their victims in the mythological implications of their deeds. For they envisaged in the struggle a war of dragons, the victory of Marduk over Tiamat, the dragon of chaos, symbolically represented by the many mutilations and cuttings off of show members which followed the slaying. The whole execution lasted hardly 2 hours. At its end, Sichem, the son of the castle, shamefully disfigured, stuck head down in the waste-pipe of his own latrine. And the body of Weser-ke-Bastet, with its draggled garland, lay bleeding in the street, having suffered a deprivation which the eye of his ancestral religion would have viewed as more serious than death. Old Hamor had simply died of fright. Dinah, the blameless, insignificant cause of so much desolation, was restored to her family. The pillage went on for a long time. That old wish-dream of the brethren came to pass. They comforted their souls with rapine, a brilliant haul. The very considerable riches of the city came into the hands of the victors, and they returned home at the end of the last watch of the night, with their prisoners in chains, with high-piled loads of golden sacrificial jugs and basins, sacks full of rings, hoops, buckles, girdles, and necklaces, with fine household gear in silver, amber, faience, alabaster, cornelian, and ivory, to say nothing of the crops and stores, the flax, oil, flour, and wine, resembled a triumph. Jacob did not leave his tent when they came. He had occupied great part of his wakefulness that night in making a sin offering to the imageless God under the sacred trees near his camp. The blood of a milk lamb had flowed upon the stone, and the fat been burnt with fragrant drugs and spices. But now, when his sons entered his tent, all glowing, swollen with pride, bringing with them the sister they had so horribly rescued, he lay shrouded upon his face, and for long would not be moved to look either at her or his bloodthirsty sons. "Away!" he cried with a gesture of repulsion. Fools and accursed ones! They stood defiantly, pursing their lips. Should we, asked one of them, let him deal with our sister as with a whore? Lo, we have washen our hearts clean. Here is Leah's child. She is 77 times avenged. He kept silent and would not uncover his head. Then they said, if our Lord would deign to look upon the things which are outside, there is much more to come, for we left men to bring up the townsmen's flocks from the fields and lead them to the tents of Israel. Then he sprang up and lifted his clenched fists above their heads so that they shrank back. Accursed be your anger, he cried out with all his strength, that it is so violent, and ye so stiff-necked in your rage. For ye have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land like an ass that is troubled by flies. When they gather themselves together against me, what then? I, being a few in number, they will slay me and my house, and the blessing of Abraham will be lost, which ye should continue into the centuries, and that which has been founded will be broken. Ye bloodthirsty ones, for ye go to avenge your hurts and to make us rich for the moment, and are too feeble in your heads to think of the future, the covenant, and the promise. They only stood there, pursing their lips. They knew nothing else but to repeat, shall they then deal with our sister as with an harlot? Yes, he screamed, beside himself, to their horror. Rather that than endanger our lives and the blessing. Hast thou conceived? He went on to Dinah, where she cowered miserably on the ground. How can I know? She wailed. The child shall not live, he said with decision, and she wailed afresh. More quietly he spoke. Israel will set forth with all that is his, and remove with all his flocks and possessions which ye have taken with the sword for Dinah's sake. For it is not meet for him to remain in the place of this abomination. I have had a vision in the night, and the Lord spake to me in a dream, take up thy route towards Bethel. Away, and put our goods together. The vision and the command had actually been vouchsafed to him, when, after the sacrifice by night, while his sons were pillaging the city, he had fallen into a doze in his tent. It was a reasonable vision, and after his own heart. For Luz, the place of sanctuary, which he knew so well, had, under these circumstances, great attraction. If he went thither, it was as though he had taken flight to the feet of God the King. Fugitives from Shechem, escaped from that bloody marriage feast, were indeed on their way towards the neighboring cities to tell the tale, and likewise just at this time certain letters, written by the various heads and shepherds of the cities of Canaan and Amor, had reached the city of Amun, in order to be laid before Horus in the palace, the sacred majesty of Amenhotep III. Most unfortunately indeed, because this deity was at the time suffering from an attack of nerves due to an abscess in his tooth, such as often afflicted him. Also, he was preoccupied with the erection of a marvelous forecourt for the Amun Temple of the southern quarter of the city, and the building of his own tomb on the western side, so that he simply had no ear at all for any disquieting news from the wretched Amun country, to the effect that the cities of the king are lost, and the land of the Pharaohs is fallen to the Kabirites, who have plundered all the countries of the king. For so it was written in the letters of the shepherds and chiefs. These documents, accordingly, which had moreover sounded rather comic at court on account of their faulty mastery of the Babylonian tongue, found their way into the archives without producing in the mind of Pharaoh any resolve to take steps against the robbers. So that here again Jacob's people might boast of their good fortune. Likewise, the nearby cities had been put in awe by the extraordinary savagery of the attack and made no head against the perpetrators. Thus Jacob the father, having undertaken a general purification, having collected the numerous idols which in these 4 years had found their way into his camp, and buried them with his own hands under the sacred trees, might set himself in leisurely motion with all his goods and chattels, and leaving in his rear that place of horror over which the vultures were circling, go jogging off toward Bethel on made roads. Dinah and her mother Leah were mounted on the same strong and intelligent camel. They rode in baskets slung under a canopy on both sides of the animal's hump. Dinah let down the shade and rode for the most part in darkness. She was with child. When her time came, the infant she brought into the world was exposed by the stern command of her menfolk. She herself pined and withered long before her time. When she was 15, her poor little face looked like an old woman's. Chapter 4. The Flight. The Primordial Bleating. These are grievous tales, and Jacob the father was weighty with them, stately and bowed down as by his manifold possessions, by the latest and only just happened, as well as by the old and ancient, by stories and by history too. History is that which has happened and that which goes on happening in time. But also it is the stratified record upon which we set our feet, the ground beneath us, and the deeper the roots of our being go down into the layers that lie below and beyond the fleshly confines of our ego, yet at the same time feed and condition it, so that in our moments of less precision we may speak of them in the first person and as though they were part of our flesh and blood experience, the heavier is our life with thought, the weightier is the soul of our flesh. When Jacob came again to Hebron, called also the town of Phor, when he returned to the tree of wisdom, planted and blessed by Abram, whether the Abiram or another unknown one, and entered once more his father's house, after having meantime suffered that sorest blow, of which I shall speak in due course, Isaac declined and died, being a very old man and blind, a gray-haired old man bearing that ancestral name Yitzchak, son of Abram. And in the dread hour before his death, he spoke to Jacob and to the others who were by, in high and awe-inspiring tones, very darkly and oracularly, of himself as the rescued sacrifice, and of the blood of the ram, which was to be thought of as his very own blood, the true son's, poured out in sin-offering for all. Yes, just before the end, he essayed with remarkable success to bleat like a sheep, and his bloodless face took on an astounding likeness to the countenance of that animal, or rather, they were conscious all at once that the likeness had always been there, to an extent that they were all horrified, and made haste to fall upon their faces in order not to see how the son became a ram. While he began again to speak, calling the ram Father and God. A god shall they slay, he babbled, in ancient and poetic language, and went on with his head bent back, his eyes wide open and fixed, and his fingers spread out, to say that they should all hold a sacrificial meal with the flesh and the blood of the slain ram, as he and Abram had once done, the father and son, for whom the god and father beast had intervened. Lo, it was slain, they heard him rattle in his throat. He went babbling and rambling on, they not daring to look at him. The father and the beast, instead of the man and the son. And we ate. But verily I say to you, there shall be slain the man and the son instead of the beast, and in the place of God, and ye shall eat. Then he bleated again in a most lifelike manner, and then he died. They remained some time upon their faces after he stopped speaking, uncertain whether he were really dead and would not speak and bleat again. It was with them all as though their entrails turned over within them, and the undermost came uppermost, so that they could have brought it all up. For the words and bearing of the dying man had about them something aboriginally indecent, something grisly, yet primevally, pre-religiously sacred, which lay beneath all the civilized layers, in the most unregarded, forgotten, and ultra-personal depths of their souls, and had been turned uppermost by the death of Yitzhak, with nauseating effect. An obscene apparition out of the faraway and deep-down past of the animal that was God. Namely, the ram, the god-ancestor of the race from which it came down, and whose divine and tribal blood they had once in that unspeakable aforetime poured out and consumed in order to strengthen the bond between the tribe and the beast god. That was before he came, the god from far away, Elohim, the god from beyond and above, god of the wilderness and god of the moon peak, who had chosen them, severed the connection between them and their primitive nature, married them with the ring of circumcision, and established a new beginning of God in time. Hence it was they were sick at sight of Yitzhak's ram-like face and his bleating. Jacob himself had felt sick, but also he had felt mightily exalted when he presided over the burying. Barefoot and dust-strewn, with shorn head, he had attended to the rites, the wailings, and the sacrificial vessels for offerings to the dead. He and Esau, the pipe-playing goat, who had come from his goat mountain to help bury his father in the double tomb, and with tear-wet beard to add his childishly unrestrained howls to the hoyadon of the male and female singers. Together they sewed up Yitzhak in a ram skin, with his knees under his chin. And thus they gave him to time to devour, to time, which devours his children, that they may not set themselves over him, but must choke them up again to live in the same old stories as the same children. For the giant cannot tell by touching it that the artful mother has only given him a thing like a stone wrapped up in his skin, and not the child. Woe, alas, for the Lord! That had often been cried over Yitzhak, the rescued sacrifice, and many a time and oft had he lived again in his tales, telling them in the first person, as was right. Partly because his ego faded out and back into the archetype, partly because what had been had now become the present in his flesh, and might have repeated itself conformably to the foundation. In this sense had Jacob and the rest heard and understood it, when dying he spoke again of the averted sacrifice, heard as it were with a double ear, yet understood in a single sense. Just as we, in fact, hear with two ears and see with two eyes, yet grasp the thing heard and seen as one. Moreover, Yitzhak was a very old man, talking about a little boy who had been near being killed. Whether the child had once been himself, or an earlier one, was scarcely pertinent, since in any case the remote, little, almost sacrifice could not have been stranger or more utterly outside of himself than the boy which Yitzhak had once been.